We'll take case number one under advisement. Global Relief Foundation versus Paul H. O'Neill. And
please the court. I'm Roger Simmons, counsel for Global Relief Foundation. I have what is unique in my career, a case in which I come before the court and I've never seen the record I'm appealing from, at least the part that Judge Anderson ruled on and called a classified record. I was present, Your Honors, on December 14 in the Office of the Global Relief last year when the FBI and Global had the visitors from the Treasury Department walk into this U.S. corporation, one that Judge Anderson has acknowledged is a U.S. chartered domestic corporation located here in the Chicago suburbs. It is one in which
I'm emphasizing that, but if Al-Qaeda got a Delaware charter, which it could just by sending a notice to the Secretary of State, what difference would that make?
Because you know and I know that no one has ever alleged, charged, or made any complaint or assertion that Al-Qaeda has a charter here. And you know as well as I do that there's been no indictment.
Please
no
keep your mouth.
Counsel,
we can hear you, and you don't have
I
to raise your
mouth. I understand the difference between a hypothetical question and a statement of the record. I'm asking you a hypothetical question.
All right.
What difference would it make if Al-Qaeda sent a notice the Secretary of State of Delaware and chartered itself as a Delaware corporation? Do you think it would make any difference?
The truth of the matter is, Al-Qaeda has never been charged with that.
This is a hypothetical question. Please deal with it.
What is it you want me to deal with? You know the answer to that, Your Honor. Al-Qaeda would be indicted immediately. There are criminal laws to deal with it.
Then I'm not sure why you keep emphasizing that it makes a difference that your client has a charter as a U.S. corporation.
It makes a difference because it's a U.S. citizen with constitutional rights.
But you just told me, maybe you didn't tell me, that if Al-Qaeda became a U.S. citizen, it would make no difference.
But if Al-Qaeda were doing it, Your Honor, Al-Qaeda would be doing it with, in a situation of fraud. That's not been charged here.
But what?
Al-Qaeda would be doing it for fraudulent purposes.
No, Al-Qaeda would file a completely truthful and accurate statement with the Delaware Secretary of State.
And at that point,
Cosa Nostra could incorporate in Delaware. There's absolutely no limit.
But there,
it's just a notice state. You send in a form, you get a corporate certificate back.
And what you're saying is Illinois in that situation has acknowledged Cosa Nostra as a legal entity, Al-Qaeda as a legal entity. It's appropriate and proper under Illinois laws for that entity to have a corporation here, and Illinois has said under our statutes and our corporate charters, it's okay for that entity to have this corporation and operate it here as an Illinois corporation. Once having done that, that entity has the constitutional rights, as we all do, as U.S. citizens. And there's no dispute here that this is a U.S. citizen. There's no dispute here that these are U.S. assets. In fact, Judge Anderson notes that at pages 10, 19, 17, 18. He says specifically at page 19, Global Relief Foundation is a U.S. citizen. He says at page 17, Global Relief.
Let me be more explicit.
Okay.
One of your arguments is that the federal statute authorizing the blocking of assets does not apply to U.S. citizens. Now, a logical implication of that argument would be that if Al-Qaeda chose to become a U.S. citizen, then its assets could no longer be blocked. Is that your position?
Your Honor, I'm having a hard time dealing with that situation because I can't conceive of the U.S. letting them do it. But if the U.S. were to let them do it, and Illinois were to let them do it, yes, it would suddenly be a U.S. citizen. And it would have the constitutional rights of all U.S. citizens.
Look, forget the Constitution for a second. You make arguments about the meaning of the statute under which the asset blocking occurred. One of your arguments, if I understand you correctly, is that the president cannot block the assets of U.S. citizens. Now, if that is true, does it not follow that if Al-Qaeda incorporates in Delaware, its assets can no longer be blocked?
No, it doesn't.
Then I don't understand the argument. You're no longer arguing that U.S. citizens have a free pass under this statute.
Al-Qaeda is not and never was a U.S. citizen. And the people that are involved here are not Al-Qaeda. They are not people that came here illegally. They are people that were long-term U.S. residents. They include U.S. citizens. And at this point, they're a majority on the board of U.S. citizens. So when you say Al-Qaeda, in that sense, you're doing what Justice Jackson warned of in the Youngstown case, Your Honor. That is, in his words, the opinions of judges, no less than executives and publicists, often suffer the infirmity of confusing the issue of a power's validity with the cause it is invoked to promote, of confounding the permanent executive office with its temporary occupant. And then in that context, he says, the tendency is strong to emphasize transient results, to emphasize them, and then emphasize the transient results upon policies such as, in that case, wage and stabilization, here, security and concerns of terrorism, and lose sight of the enduring consequences upon the balanced power structure of our republic. And what, in doing that, what everybody forgets in this situation, no one's ever accused Al-Qaeda of having incorporated Global Relief. No one's ever accused any of the directors of Global Relief of being Al-Qaeda. No one's ever accused them of doing violent things or supporting terrorism. No one brought a case against them or put a piece of evidence before any court or had any finding here. If there is such evidence, it's evidence I haven't seen. It's in a secret record. It's perhaps before this court, because I know the government invited you to go look at these secret evidence, but I don't know whether you looked at it or not. I know that Judge Anderson did, and I know he relied on it. And what that does, Your Honor, it creates a systematic change in the way courts function. Instead of my being able as an advocate to point out that evidence was or was not fairly interpreted, fairly presented, supported by the rational facts, I am led to wonder what exactly the violation is, what the statute is we're trying to defend under. I'm left to wonder what person or of 150 possibilities that worked in different times and places over a 10-year period for this entity could have, would have, might have done something wrong. I don't have a clue as I stand here what the criminality is that they've charged. And yet I'm told this entity has been placed on a blacklist, a list of entities known as specially designated government terrorists. I have the unfortunate task of coming before this court working in the dark in guesswork in a way no attorney has ever had to work.
Since that has happened, is not the case that you have appeal here moot? Appeal moot?
Your Honor is referring to the suggestion of mootness and the threat or the promise made on May 24.
Judge Anderson didn't address the question that you were just talking about, did he?
Yep. Your Honor, it was before him. We put it before him in a supplement to our preliminary injunction motion right after May 24 when the government said it was considering that. We asked that be included as part of the injunction. We did that, and within 2 days, the government replied to it. When I was before the court in April, and Judge Easterbrook, you know, as Judge Posner and Judge Wood ruled, that this issue of the secret record would be something that would be heard fully on this record once the preliminary injunction issue was resolved. the secret evidence is something that is used as part of the record the government is using and has used to designate us as a specially designated terrorist. The fact is, what they have done is made permanent what they did and purported to be permanent, or no, purported to be temporary, for 10 months prior to the time they did that. The difference.
Well, I think you mentioned, at least in the other aspects of this case, and perhaps in your motion that you made last May or first of June, that you were seeking an injunction against designation, but now designation has taken place. Doesn't that make your case moot as to the injunction against it?
You can argue justice delayed or justice denied.
The case has gone beyond the point where you presented it to the district court.
I acknowledge my case is difficult because they have placed the company in a situation where they have, as in their press release, they said they're conducting a war against us. They say their intent was to bankrupt us and the war of attrition, freeze, take away all of our documents, our ability to function as a company, take away our donors, do everything that's possible to drive us out of business. They've come close to doing that. I hang by fingernails hoping that the court will give me some justice someday in court, some opportunity to see the evidence, some ability to know what the charge is, some ability to be able to present my own case and defend against it.
You're repeating now what you said earlier.
I don't mean to do that.
If you want to continue that, go ahead, because you're just wasting your time.
Your Honor, I will reserve my rebuttal time. I didn't mean to repeat, but what I'm saying is it is still as much part of this case as it was before the actual permanent designation as it was before they threatened to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Douglas Letter from the United States Department of Justice, representing the government here as appellee. With me today are Tom Byron, John Smith, and Adam Zubin from the Department of Justice, and Thomas Walsh from the United States Attorney's Office. Let me just start out by saying, as the court is aware, we're happy to have this argument take place in open court. If the court has any questions about the classified information, I'd be pleased to respond to them, but obviously the courtroom would need to be cleared at that stage. As everybody is aware, global terrorism relies in part on the movement of money and money that is raised in the United States. The government is taking vigorous actions as part of an international effort to interrupt the flow of that funding. What we have here is a situation where the government received evidence, both classified and unclassified, that raised significant questions about whether Global Relief was providing assistance, either through funds or other means, to recognize global terrorists. And so the government acted to block in aid of investigation so that it could investigate further whether that is indeed what GRIF is doing. As the court knows, the appeal before it now is purely about the blocking in aid of investigation. At the time that this complaint was filed and the preliminary injunction was sought, there was no actual designation. The designation
It's hard to say it's purely about that. There are arguments that, if accepted, would knock out any ability to block this organization's assets now, in the future, in any way.
That is correct, Your Honor. And so the question is, was Global Relief bringing those issues properly before the district court? But even more important, was it bringing them before this court in its opening brief? This court obviously can read the brief as easily as we can. We found it very difficult to see any arguments about that in the
opening. It is a little hard to parse, I will grant, but it does seem to be arguing, for example, that the basic blocking statute doesn't apply to citizens, that the president did not delegate his powers properly to the Secretary of the Treasury, that any application of this statute is unconstitutional as an ex post facto law,
right,
that it violates the due process clause to have seized the assets without a prior hearing, and all of these arguments seem to be of continuing applicability.
They certainly could be, Honor, so let me just go directly to them. For example, the argument about that the IEPA doesn't authorize the blocking of...
Is that the official pronounced way to pronounce this unpronounceable acronym?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I've struggled with this, and I've asked the agency if we could avoid acronyms, and they tell me, no, everybody knows this is IEPA, so I'm sure you know it as IEPA.
I try hard not to know laws by unpronounceable acronyms.
Let's call it the Emergencies Act.
Okay.
As the Emergencies Act is very broadly worded, the Supreme Court has acknowledged and recognized that it is broadly worded, that it covers any interest, the interest held by a foreign national. If the argument by Griff were accepted, it would mean that suppose there were a German citizen who owned 100% a corporation that were then incorporated in the United States, that would not be within the president's authority to block. That clearly is inconsistent with the wording of the statute, and as I say, is inconsistent with the Supreme Court statement that we do look to the wording of the statute.
So the technical question is, what does the word interest mean? Does it mean legal interest or beneficial interest? Because the corporation is the only legal owner of its property, even though the shareholders or in a nonprofit corporation, the trustees may have a beneficial interest.
That's right, Your Honor.
And how do we tell whether it means legal interest or beneficial interest?
As you know, the district court, and if I will answer your question, I just want to point out on almost everything I say, we refer the court to the district court's opinion because the district court really wrote a very thorough analysis here. Your Honor, first, obviously, you look to the wording of the statute and then the implementation of it by the agency that is charged with implementing it, which is the president and then the...
Agencies always implement statutes in a way that maximizes their own power.
And
it doesn't imply that they're always right.
That is correct, Your Honor, but I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, that the Supreme Court has said in cases such as Chevron that courts defer to those types of interpretations by the agency. There is nothing in the statute that would limit it to legally cognizable, legally enforceable interests, and indeed that would severely undermine the broad purposes that the statute is meant to provide. And I think that that's shown best by the very type of case we have here. We have a national security case where we are attempting to stop the flow of international terrorism. It's going to be extremely rare that there's going to be an actual legal contract between a group like Al-Qaeda or Hamas and an entity in the United States. But there are going to be any number of factual circumstances, and we believe that the classified evidence in this case presents a good example of it, when there is certainly, using your Honor's word, the beneficial interest by foreign entities.
On a slightly different subject, back in what May, I think, you announced that you are now going to proceed to the designation phase of the proceeding. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Global Relief filed a response to that announcement in which they pretty clearly dealt with the designation phase of the proceeding. But when you filed your response, filed your suggestion of mootness, you didn't ever mention that filing as being a place where there was discussion and of the... Is that correct?
No, we did refer to that, Your Honor. I don't have it with me at the lecture.
It seemed to me that that was pretty clearly concerned with the question of designation.
Your Honor,
maybe you didn't mention it. I didn't...
Your Honor, I don't mean to quibble with you. We did specifically reference it. I think it's about page 12 or so of our filing. We did note that. We said we didn't think it was clear, but the key thing was, as you see, the main argument we made in that motion was that if this argument was to be preserved before this court, it had to be stated in the opening brief, and we felt that was not clearly stated, that what Griff was doing was arguing that the district court should have entered an injunction in advance of the designation. Going to one of the points that my brother counsel made about the in-camera ex-party review by the district court of the classified material, obviously this is something that is to be avoided in American courts in almost all circumstances, and we fully recognize that, and in fact the Attorney General has regulations indicating that the Justice Department is to push for open judicial proceedings whenever possible. However, there are some clearly recognized and now fully applied by this court's sister circuits instances in which, unfortunately, in-camera ex parte review of material by the neutral Article III judges is necessary. For example, under FISA, several courts have ruled specifically this is constitutional. Under the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1996, on which the Patriot Act here was patterned, the D.C. Circuit has on several occasions now held specifically that in-camera ex parte review is appropriate. And as we cite in our brief, there are other cases, for instance, where the government asserts a state secrets privilege and material is reviewed by the court in order to determine the merits, even of constitutional claims. And so, again, while this is certainly a narrow scope of cases, it is well recognized by the courts of appeals that this type of procedure is appropriate. I'm happy to address any of the other points that are covered in the brief or in the district court's opinion. As I say, I believe that the district court dealt with all of the various statutory and constitutional arguments that Griff has raised. As I say, if the court has questions, I'm pleased to respond to them. Otherwise, we urge the court to affirm because the district court has thoroughly and correctly analyzed the issues. Thank you.
Anything else, Dennis? All right. Thank you, counsel.
Sometimes a good question produces more heat than light, and I apologize, I think I gave you heat back. Thinking about your question and trying to answer it more with more light than heat this time, Judge Easterbrook, I think the answer is that if Osama bin Laden came to Illinois and attempted to incorporate, or did incorporate, General Motors of Chicago, the answer is that you could use IEPA to a degree there. You could freeze his stock interest in General Motors of Illinois or Chicago, but you couldn't freeze the entity, at least not without giving its day in court access to the evidence. And when my colleague asserts that other courts have bought into and adopted and are now saying it.
My question is, why not? The same question I asked Mr. Letter. Does the word interest in this statute, whose acronym I still refuse to pronounce, does the word interest in this statute mean legal interest, beneficial interest, or some other thing? See, one could think it would mean beneficial interest because the goal of this statute is to stop the distribution of particular assets, and that indicates a concern about where it's going, what the effective control is, rather than who the technical legal owner is.
I hear what you're saying, but that question really was answered in Dames and Moore versus Reagan back by Justice Rehnquist and his court in the early 80s. And the answer is that the interest that the IEPA was enacted to deal with is truly the kind of property interest that you can enforce and have legal control over. It's not something like the type of interest they're saying is if we have a constituency in Kosovo of people dying of starvation and they need to be fed by humanitarian aids of Global. He's saying that type of interest is enough of an interest because it's an expectation of a gift. At no place in IEPA and in no place in the Dames and Moore opinion was that type of interest acknowledged as being the kind IEPA could address. Because if you take it that broadly in our global society, you could apply IEPA, really, to take over summarily and do away with, frankly, this court and all other courts, because you do it on the secret record, of General Motors, IBM, Chrysler with its huge Daimler-Benz involvement. Anytime you have a foreign interest, you don't have to go show a specific violation, which they've not pointed to here. They've not pointed to a specific violation of a statute, an executive order, or any other criminal regulation that we can address or put evidence on. And so we're sitting here in the dark wondering what it is we did. As best as we could come up with, it's like the Joint Anti-Fascist League. We're put on a list of people that believe like those people that are bad. And so we're in the same position as McCarthy targets in the 50s. And it brings back an era that I, as a young man, hoped never would come again. But we seem to be in it. And I, for one, I'm glad I'm not of the Islamic faith, or I'd be more nervous than I am representing this entity, because as I go along today, I'm not sure under FISA whether all my phone calls are monitored. And I treat it as though it is. It's the kind of thing I can never know whether the government has decided that somehow I'm a threat, because they won't let me see the evidence either in front of the agency or in front of the court either. So where do you go with this, and who do you exclude, and why has this company been called an enemy of the country to be ground under and bankrupted, Your Honor? Thank you.
All right, counsel. The court will take this case under advice.